Morning, everyone. Thank you. Any physicians or pediatricians in the group? There we go. Okay, this may be pertinent to the group. As requested, there is no financial, commercial, or research relationship to this disclosure. Okay. During the time of this simple study that I'm going to present to you, I was a general pediatrician, solo practitioner in a busy practice in southwest rural Pennsylvania. So as you can see, my career has changed a little bit, but I decided to ask a question a few years back, and it resulted in this, I think, simple study. As a point of reference, most of the research work was done by my office nurse between patients and at home. Some background information. According to the impact of war on children in the countries of the former Yugoslavia, the role of doctors as a conscience of the community deserves more consideration in times of stress and under difficult circumstances such as war. Pediatricians and children's doctors in particular have a professional obligation to act to protect children under such circumstances. As some of us know, based on who's in the audience today, the American Academy of Pediatrics is comprised of about 60,000 pediatricians, and it's committed to the optimal physical, mental, and social well-being and health of infants, children, and adolescents, and young adults. And it is dedicated to the health of all children, as mentioned in its bylaws. According to surveys by UNICEF in Sarajevo, Bosnia, and Herzegovina, 55% of children have been shot at, 60% had been in a situation where they expected to die, and 29% felt unbearable sorrow. According to the section on international child health from the American Academy of Pediatric newsletter, fall 2004, Angola, 66% of children had seen people being murdered, and 67% had seen people being tortured, beaten, or hurt. In Rwanda, 56% had seen children kill people, nearly 80% had lost immediate family members, and 16% had been forced to hide under dead bodies. More than 60% of the children did not care whether they ever grew up. In January 1990, the Convention on the Rights of Children, adopted by the UN General Assembly and signed by 61 countries except the United States and Somalia. In time of war, the convention requires nations to ensure respect for international humanitarian rules of war, to refrain from recruiting or otherwise involving an armed conflict children under age of 15. It was interesting, at least on my part, to notice that I really did not see much in our large syllabus regarding the rights of children in this situation as it relates to the United States not signing yet that document yet. So that was of interest to me in my review of the material that was presented over these past few days. The pediatric community can make a tremendous contribution by providing support and technical assistance to the organizations and local communities who continue to struggle to support children in conflict. So this particular study was really a two-fold study, had two components to it. We surveyed physicians in practice in Pennsylvania, and this was out of my small office, but busy office in Johnstown, Pennsylvania. We did receive support from the American Academy of Pediatrics in identifying the pediatricians living in Pennsylvania. And interestingly enough, I first offered this topic for presentation in 2006 and updated it for this particular presentation. So what we did was review the American Academy of Pediatric newsletters from 2004 through 2005, and again from 2008 to 2010. We also looked at the AAP policy statements from that period of time, and in the journal for those period of time. And the second component was to survey the pediatricians in southwest Pennsylvania. And what we were looking for in the written material from the American Academy of Pediatrics was a statement or reference regarding the prevention of pediatric deaths in a wartime conflict. We often read about what we as healthcare providers are doing, providing some level of service after the event, but I was noticing as a general pediatrician sitting in my office or at home reading the journals that national and worldwide academy dedicated to all children was not really commenting on the prevention of injuries and death to children in a wartime conflict. In the review of the AAP newsletters, we did observe comments on the rights of children. There was no specific comment, however, on the prevention of pediatric deaths in the wartime conflicts. And these monthly newsletters would come out to or be available to all pediatricians who were members of the academy. Regarding the policy statements, we did find a statement regarding health equity and the rights of children, and comments promoting the principles and practices of equity-based clinical care advocacy, children and family-centered public policy, looking at the rights of children, but again, nothing related to the exact prevention of deaths. And in a AAP meeting presentation, Dr. Goldhagen did comment on the physical needs, social and cultural needs, intellectual, psychological, and emotional trauma related to death, to the injuries and wartime consequences of children, but not to the prevention. Again, these were two more documents that we reviewed, again, not commenting specifically on prevention. So in the first part of this, the simple study done out of an office, we really, again, could not find any documentation in the standard American Academy of Pediatric literature, either through policy statements, the journal, or the monthly newsletters, commenting on any role the American Academy of Pediatrics was taking regarding prevention. They were active in commenting on the rights of children, surely, and on the great things the individuals, pediatricians, and the academy was doing regarding support to refugees and injuries and, to families after an event. So I decided to develop a very simple survey and send it to the pediatricians in Pennsylvania. We observed that regarding the physician activity or Pennsylvania physician activity in the American Academy of Pediatrics, of the physicians polled, about 4% stated that they were very active, 43% moderately active, and over half were either minimally active or not active at all, which I thought was interesting. And here's a visual effect of those findings from the physicians in Pennsylvania. And then we asked the question, do you feel the AAP takes a strong political advocacy position on war and its effects on children worldwide? 5% said the AAP takes a strong public advocacy role, 53% a moderate, and about 40% stated that it was a minimal to no role on this issue. And another visual graph to demonstrate that. Should the AAP more formally address the issue of war and its effect on children? And the Pennsylvania pediatrician surveyed, 66% should the American AAP should take a more formal role to address this issue. And 34%, and I thought this was the interesting number, said we should not. And again, this is a graphic on that. Would you consider a greater level of participation in the AAP if the Academy more formally addressed issues of war and poverty? And I thought this was it turned out that I thought this was an interesting question based on the fact that a good number of pediatricians felt that the Academy should not, but now this question was related individually to them as pediatricians. 36% would become more active, and 64% would not consider increase in activity. So I guess if the AAP wanted to have an increase in membership, they would say something about war and the effects of children and how we can prevent injuries and death to children in war. Conclusion, programs have been established or supported by the AAP that address the plight of refugees. However, there seems to be a lack of direct political advocacy by the AAP regarding war and how to prevent pediatric deaths, injury, and hardship in these environments. Potentially, the questions raised to ourselves as pediatricians and potentially to the American Academy of Pediatrics would require that we look at ourselves more as a worldwide community rather than a national community. And the AAP seems to be doing most of its very good work in this country, with sections working at the sections within the American Academy of Pediatrics working at the international level, but not necessarily transcribing that information or level of interest to the entire body of the American Academy of Pediatrics. How can we best enhance the public training of pediatricians, and how do we direct community pediatricians more into the community? And I'll stop there. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Matt. So we can open up to questions now for any of the speakers. Does anybody have? Jonathan.
Just a comment on our first speaker and then maybe a second question for our next speaker. A number of years ago, Physicians for National Health Program sent me to Malaysia soon after the Tiger economy collapsed to talk about some of the structural, what's the term again?
Adjustment. What, if you'd like to comment, come on up.
Yeah,
do you want to come to the mic so we can record it?
Can you hear me?
Well, it needs to be recorded.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yes, you know, I have a background in international health and pediatrics and have been active in that area. And I was just quite amazed and surprised that there was not some comment in the AAP literature. Yes, it's an issue pertaining to the individual pediatricians in Pennsylvania, but more concerning was the national organization, and how can we, in ways maybe other than putting their name in the paper, which may have to come at some point, but how can we get pediatricians, and how can we get the American Academy of Pediatrics and other organizations? This organization, I did not see much. In the review of the curriculum in this rather lengthy book regarding the Rights of Children Convention and what this organization was doing in getting the United States to sign on to that document. I didn't see much in the way of presentations. The same goes for the American Academy of Pediatrics. So I don't think it's just singular to a group of pediatricians in Pennsylvania. It's how we perceive the rights of children in this country in general, period. Thank you.
Another question, Randy.
In the first two presentations, it's shocking that the health professionals are participating as prison guards rather than as caregivers. And there have been been some very effective efforts to make sure that health professionals who participate consciously in torture cannot be relicensed and should not be treating patients. And those are good initiatives. And that the immorality of that question in the first presentation made me think, again, these are the crimes of Nuremberg. So would you comment?
Go ahead, sure. Excuse me, sorry. I agree with you. It's an ongoing problem. I'll only comment about the situation in the detention system, but there are a lot of problems, instances with health professionals that are getting too engaged in security policies, engaged in using shackles, sending people to solitary confinement as punishment, overuse of psychotropic drugs, things like this. And I don't disagree with your characterization that it can be, you know, the stuff of Nuremberg. Obviously, it's very difficult to bring these issues up with health professionals. We look at it through a different frame, through the dual, as a, you know, a dual loyalties issue. And probably many of you are familiar with this concept. It's the idea that health professionals are often prevented or prohibited to some degree to giving the best care to their patients and to fulfilling their duty to care for patients because they've got third-party interests pulling on them. In this case, in the case of the immigration detention system, they've got security and the agency interests in deporting people, often preventing them, from fulfilling their loyalty obligations to patients. And it can be, you know, a very minor transgression, but it can, if it's out of control and when there's not good monitoring and evaluation of these systems, it can lead to egregious conduct. I completely agree with you.
Thanks. Any other questions? Yes.
I have a question about the status of children or adolescents being confined in immigration facilities. I understand that's been done until quite recently. And I wonder if you want to address that.
Sure.
We wouldn't tolerate that if the town drunk was put in jail and their child come from.
Right. It's a very interesting problem. There's a Texas center called the Don Hutto that was a family immigration detention center. And it's actually fascinating to me because I like to think I'm optimistic, and I like to think that when they came up with this concept, that they were trying to do the right thing, that they were trying not to separate the kids from their parents and things like that. But of course, the reality is that then you have whole families, children included, living behind barbed wire, living essentially in prison conditions. So there was a great outcry about this particular center, and it has been shut down. And the system is, as I understand it, overwhelmingly trying to divert children not to detention center kind of facilities, but to more, I mean, you know, they're still kind of social service facilities, like, you know, it's like an orphanage or something like that. The interesting thing is that it's just so wildly uneven, the conditions in these. Some of them are very stark, austere conditions with not much going on, and yet I know of at least one other facility in Texas that's gorgeous. The kids have their own, you know, really gorgeous swimming pool, and they have private rooms, and they have a lot going on. So I think one of the biggest problems that plagues the immigration detention system, as it relates to children, as it relates to everyone, is that because it is such a huge, sprawling system encompassing so many different facilities, that the level of care and the level of conditions is just completely uneven, and it's really just the luck of the draw in where you get placed and what kind of care you get while you're there. Thank you.
Other questions? Yes.
I have a question for Christy. Sure. I'm for a local health department. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for our county. And we want to get out and, you know, talk to these people and talk to their contacts and family contacts, but in that isolated, people don't want to talk to you, obviously.
No, they don't.
So do you have examples of where local public health departments working with these detention facilities, a good working relationship where we can work on things like that?
Unfortunately, no, it's a great point that you raise. Unfortunately, we don't, and so I'd like to exchange information with you afterwards so we can see about what we can do to figure out what more places are doing at the local level and how we can enhance communication. The problem is that I gave the quote from Division of Immigration Health Services, and they're responsible at the top level for provision of health care, and they are directly responsible for provision of health care at the government-owned facilities and to a great extent also at the contract facilities. But at the local levels, at the jails and prisons, the health care there is done by all sorts. I mean, again, it varies wildly by local community centers, by local for-profit health agencies and things like that. So very difficult to track. I think it's different in every town, but I think it would be definitely worthwhile in trying to track that information and trying to make some introductions and see what best practices are occurring at the local level. And maybe they can, you know, sort of trickle up if it looks like it's going well that way, and maybe the local practices can inform the national practices better. Thank you for raising that point.
Jonathan.
If I'm kind of the last, I'll say,
okay,
if I may, educate, agitate, organize. Everybody who's in this room has seen some of this data about what's happening with the immigrants, what's happening with children in the countries involved in war, what's happening with the eco-political system and the way it works. It's not enough just to walk out and get educated. It's important for us all to go home and take an action step. Mm-hmm. So I would encourage everybody here to be more about this, either to self-educate, to join PHR, and encourage its good work. I'm going to talk to this man about how to get his research out there, because I think this is shameful, and we need to publicize it one way or the other. So I'm going to exchange some information with our doctor friend here about what can we do to get the rest of America to know about the research that he's discovered. I suspect, even without naming names, that the pediatricians will come around to taking a look at this sort of stuff and say, well, we need to do something, especially if we can put it into the blogs, if we can put it into the
front page of the New York Times, you mean?
We'll talk. We're going to write an article about this. Okay. Because
I'll keep my paycheck.
It's shameful. So do something. It isn't just enough to educate yourselves, educate others, agitate for change, organize. Come back to our socialist office next year. Send us ideas if you want to about the sort of sessions you'd like to have. I think you should have more stuff like this.
Well, on that note, we'll end for today, and if you have more questions, you're welcome to come up and speak with the speakers. Thank you for coming.